Words on Water.
Hi, welcome to Words on Water, a podcast from the Water Environment Federation. This is the host, Travis Loop. Joined for this episode by Greg Quist. He is CEO of Smart Cover Systems. He's the chair of the Urban Water Institute, and he is on the board of Rincon del Diablo Water District. And these are just a few of his many hats he wears. Greg, how are you doing?
Great. How are you doing today, Travis?
I'm doing pretty good. I'm very excited to talk to you, like I had mentioned, because you have had a very interesting career in water and technology. You've also been involved with kind of the water scene there in California. And so a lot of different areas for us to touch on. One of my first questions is based on looking at your bio. And I'm curious how someone who majored in astrophysics and minored in economics and then got a PhD in physics ended up in the water sector.
That's a great question. I obviously didn't start out that way, but let me go back a little bit in time to give you some context. First of all, I was born and raised in Vermont as a country boy. And one of the things I did when I wandered out at nighttime was to look at the sky, because we had a great dark sky there. And I think that became the inspiration of my, at least starting my career, an academic career in astrophysics. By the time I got, I'll shorten the whole thing up, but by the time I got to grad school at UC Santa Barbara, which is how I got to California, I'd like to do astrophysics, you know, as a career. I realized I really wasn't good enough to be a career academic astrophysics guy. So I kind of wandered off into simple theoretical physics, if you like. Got out of grad school and found a defense firm in San Diego that was doing some work and ended up working for them. Married my wife that I met in Santa Barbara, and we moved to Escondido and lived in kind of a rural area for coastal California. And that's really how I kind of ran into the water world, oddly enough, where I lived. We were in an area where there was not much housing, but after we moved in, a whole bunch of houses got built around us. And suburbia was happening, and the only really outlet that we could use to kind of talk about that was to go to the Escondido City Council and protest. So again, to shorten the story, in the summer of 1990, the mayor of Escondido, who I really didn't know very well, called me up and asked me if I would run for this board. That's a local water district. I hadn't even heard of the water district, hadn't heard of the board. I realized I was paying my bills to those folks, but you know, okay, fine. I said yes. I figured I can't lose, and I ended up beating the incumbent 2-1. And run the clock ahead. Now I've been on the Rincon board for 28 years, and thank God I was reelected this last past election. So I'm headed toward 32 years. So that's kind of how I got involved in water on the policy side. On the technology side, I'll just kind of sort of truncate the story and tell you that Rincon appointed me to the San Diego County Water Authority Board in 1996. And that's where I met my business partner, my future business partner, David Drake. David was a Caltech electrical engineering graduate, worked at JPL, so he literally was a rocket scientist. So between the two of us, we had kind of significant technical background. After the Berlin Wall fell in the early 90s and the defense industry started to contract, Dave and I kind of got involved in a couple companies that were doing kind of fun stuff in water, like detecting microorganisms in water in real time, things like cryptosporidium. And after we jettisoned one of these companies, we were literally called up three of our friends in the industry and said, what keeps you up at night? And they told us what kept them up at night was sewer spills. So in 2005, we founded this company we called Hadronix, which has become Smart Cover Systems. And we've been providing real-time monitoring for sewers and operators of sewage systems now for about 14 years. So you could sort of say my career path started out in the stars and ended up in sewage.
That is a great one. I like that a lot. So there's a bunch of paths we can go to explore here with technology and with kind of water policy and with California. So let's go with that technology route here. You've been involved with technology throughout your career, as you kind of outlined, and you've been involved with this monitoring aspect for a while. how would you describe like the current state of technology in the water sector? You've seen it change. You've seen it evolve. What's exciting about the moment we are right now?
To me, I think what's exciting is kind of on a daily basis is that I'm working in an industry that is literally providing the lifeblood to the faucets of people in this country and in this area where I live. And really, I don't think people appreciate the effort that goes on and what's been going on for decades behind the scenes to make it possible for them to walk up to their, you know, their faucets and turn it on 7/24 and have good quality, reliable, low cost water come out of the tap. And, oddly, except for maybe, you know, people like us, like you and me that live in the water sector every day, you know, water and sewage is pretty much out of sight, out of mind. And as long as things are going well, people don't really care. And the analogy I like to use is we're sort of like defensive backs in football. When they're doing their job well, you really don't notice them because no one's throwing passes to the guys they're covering. But when they miss a coverage and somebody blows by them for a touchdown, the whole stadium knows who made the mistake. And the water industry is a little bit like that. We do our job well and nobody seems to really notice. But there's lots of cases in history. For example, if you want to think about Flint, Michigan, the folks in Flint were trying to do the right thing, like changing their water supply to lower the cost of delivering water. And then they made a couple of mistakes. The first one was not recognizing that the water that they were getting that was different would had different chemistry would wear away the biofilms that coated their lead pipes, so lead got in the water. Okay, now that's bad science. The next thing they did was they covered up the mistake. Now that's criminal. And people responsible have gone to jail as they should. So incidents like Flint cause nightmares for our operators, and therefore they stick with what works. And the kind of thing is, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. So I think the frustrating thing to me about the water industry is the slow speed of adoption of technologies. And I think it's understandable given things like Flint.
Yeah. So let's build on that. The frustration of we've got all this great technology out there. There are a lot of great solutions. There's ways to deal with some of these challenges, but we're kind of sitting on our hands a little bit. Why do you think that there's that slow speed of adoption? And what do you think could be done about that?
So I think there's two parts to that. One is the inherent conservatism of the water agencies because what they've been doing has been working for long periods of time. I mean, look at chlorine. Chlorine was first introduced in the early 1900s, I believe, if not a little bit later than that. And that's still what we're using for the main disinfectant for drinking water. The second thing is every water agency is its own little universe. It doesn't necessarily have to compete with somebody next door. So I can't buy water from another water district. I'm kind of stuck with my own provider. So because all these agencies are independent agencies, there's not any competitive drive necessarily to say, hey, look, I'm doing mine better, I'm doing mine cheaper. So that conservatism also, I think, plays into it.
You've been in the technology side of things for a while. You've seen how things have changed and how they've trended. Where do you think things might be headed in 5 and 10 years?
I think that if you look back at sort of where we are today, and everyone takes it for granted that they've got a smartphone in their hand, but I think that smartphone world is really going to make a difference in the water industry. All these other technologies that came out earlier have an impact, but I think that the smartphone is the big one. And if you think about when the iPhone came out, that wasn't that long ago. And you and I look at our phones and we think, gosh, we've had these forever, but they really only came out in 2006, which is not that long ago. And I think that kind of information availability to people is going to be valuable for folks. And it's only starting to have an impact, I think, on water and sewage systems. Although there is an example, automated meter infrastructure, AMI, which came out of the power industry. And that's becoming more and more common. And it's providing useful data for our utilities as well as our customers. So I think, the huge problem that we're facing in the industry is aging infrastructure, which has been there a long time supporting water delivery and sewage collection. And the question is, where's the money going to come from to fix this $1 trillion problem? And my opinion is that, you know, what's going to happen over the next few years is that we're going to start using the more of the information technology type solutions, that our agencies are using. For example, GIS is a good example of that as well. I still run into agencies that have these huge books that weigh 50 pounds and they take them out of their trucks and put them on the front of their trucks and go, boom, here's our system. And they've got that. It's like an old Bible with coffee stains and ripped pages and all kinds of stuff. And that's the way they keep track of their pipes as opposed to sort of modern, GIS systems. So I think those kinds of things are happening slowly. And as people kind of age out of the water industry. The younger generation's coming in, and they're more facile and comfortable with information technologies. That's what's going to make a difference.
I like a bunch of those points. The one about mobile phones and having these smartphones in our hands. I wonder if you have any thoughts on how they might change things for water consumers.
So we put in AMI in our water district at Rincon about 5 years ago. We were one of the early adopters. And again, when you know what's going on out in your collection system or your distribution system, and you know it in real time, you're going to discover stuff that you didn't know about before. And one of the major things that we discovered was leaks in people's systems. So at 4 o'clock in the morning, when typically there's no household use, if there's any water running through a meter, which we could detect in real time, there's a leak in their system. And I think we've detected something like 6,000 leaks over the past 5 years.
Wow.
And we've saved several million gallons of water that way. So that was an unintended consequence. The reason we put them in was to kind of pull guys out of trucks and stop them from doing meter reading. But it turns out that data turned into something more useful. So now anybody walking around in our district can go to an application on their smartphone and see what's going on in their house and how much water is being used right now. And I think that's a very important part of, you know, customer service, and it has a very tangible outcome.
I wish I had that personally at my house. I would love to have that. I probably would spend even more time staring at my phone though, so that might not be good. Another thing that I'm really interested in is, you know, you mentioned GIS and locations and data and everything. I'm really interested in the role of satellites in the water sector and how, you know, satellites can tie into technology and provide us with this wealth of information. I know this is something that you've been directly involved with your smart cover systems. So I would love to just kind of hear about when satellites started being used with water technology and how they're used now and what the potential is.
So the availability of satellite data has, again, relatively recently been available to everybody in the water industry. Before that, it was pretty much only a Defense Department application. And by the way, GIS was the same way, right? I mean, now you can tell within meters where you were in your car. That sort of capability was not available before. Now it is with GPS. But our company, SmartCover, uses satellites to gather and send commands, you know, for our customers in sewage system. And the reason we just chose satellites rather than, say, cell phones or dedicated radio systems, which is previously what a lot of people use, was for three reasons. First, satellites are completely unaffected by terrestrial events like storms or hurricanes. So if you're monitoring somebody's distribution or collection system, typically, the time you want to know when the data is most critical is when there's bad stuff going on. And oftentimes, that's when you lose Earth-based wireless communications. And that's why our military uses things like the Iridium communication system, because hurricanes can knock out cell phones. That happened in Florida. Hurricane Irma knocked out cell phones for a couple of weeks. And the only way to communicate was with handhelds or satellite communications. Second reason is, in the case of sewers, which is what we're involved in, because sewers are run mostly by gravity, the pipes tend to be laid in the lowest possible locations. So that means that wireless communications is really kind of best looking straight up, not at the horizon, which is where cell phone towers are. They tend to be on the horizon. So they provide better communications by looking straight up. And the third thing is, and this is an interesting one, water utilities are used to putting things in the ground that last for a long time. Pipes last 50, 75, 100 years. And typically, they don't require a lot of maintenance. So since we use the Iridium satellite system, this system's had the same protocol for the past 20 years, and they just finished their last launching of the Iridium Next out of Vandenberg in January. And this next generation is going to be using the same protocols for at least another 20 years. So that time frame of a 40-year no-change protocol is important for the water industry, because you think about cell phones. They come and go quite quickly. The 2G cell systems are dead. 3G systems are shutting down at the end of this year. People are talking about 4 and 5G. So systems that would depend on obsolete or dead wireless communications have to be replaced. And our customers aren't used to doing that. They're used to putting stuff in the ground that lasts a long time. And satellites help meet that need.
You founded and spun off a number of water tech companies, something you kind of mentioned earlier on. I'm curious what that process is like, you know, from a business perspective, and what advice you might have for others that are trying to do this.
I appreciate that question, because I do like to give advice, because I've learned several ways how not to do it. I'm on my seventh water startup. I've endured several failures, and as you probably know, you learn from your mistakes, not your successes. And one of the pretty obvious reasons that I think our company now is doing well is we started by effectively having a blank sheet of paper. Dave and I had jettisoned a company in February 2005. We called up three of our friends in the water industry that we knew well, that were like us, they were policy people. And we said, hey, what keeps you up at night? That was literally the question we asked them. And when they told us that sewer spills was their problem, we were frankly surprised. So we figured out that nobody else was doing it. And we went back and asked them specifically what they wanted. So again, we had a blank sheet of paper. They said, keep the sensor out of the water, make it easy to install and service, and tell us when there's going to be a problem, before the problem occurs. And at that time in 2005, Dave and I were kind of lucky in a couple of ways. First of all, he and I both had the technical backgrounds to try to solve these problems. And second of all, if this had happened 5 years earlier, the communications wouldn't have been there, the battery types wouldn't have been there. All these new batteries that are coming along are such a big deal. If you remember the old movie about plastics, the word now should be batteries. You know, there's one word you want to remember. We didn't come up with a good idea by ourselves. We really went to the customers and said, "What problem are you having?" And I think if you try to do something and saying, "I think I got a better idea," it's really best to run it by the customers first, and especially in the water industry that's very conservative. They have a lot of problems, and you should go to them and ask them questions and say, what problems do you need to have solved? Maybe I can help you. If you don't have an answer, it's going to be hard. It's going to be a hard road.
I definitely see a lot of, on social media and other places, there's a lot of efforts to kind of incubate water startups, and especially on the technology front, and help them get going. So it's great to hear from someone that's been through this a number of times. Shifting gears a little bit, I mentioned that you're the chair of the Urban Water Institute. Could you tell me what that organization does and why it's important?
Urban Water has been around for about 26 years. It was founded by a gentleman named Wayne Clark, who passed away last year. Wayne's vision and the Institute's vision really is to have an organization that's different than a lot of the organizations out here. We have an Association of California Water Agencies, AQUA. We have the Southern California Water Committee. But we were dedicated to the dissemination of information and education on water problems, and avoiding bias and political influence, as hard as that might be. That doesn't mean we don't address these things. On the contrary, we try to have panels that are kind of like that old 60 Minutes point counterpoint, where we have folks that are on different sides of the issue bringing their ideas, because we believe that good solutions come from actually conflict and disagreement, as long as it's respectful. And in the water industry, there's a lot of mutual respect, because we're all trying to do something that's good for society. So even though we have disagreements on things, it tends not to be disagreeable. We have two conferences annually, and we try to bring the best and the brightest to talk to us about what is the absolute latest in the water industry. And we have long Q&A sessions after panels. So there's a lot of interaction going on, and we have social gatherings where there's other interactions going on. And one of our theses is really that solutions come from people, not from things. And if people that are on different sides of the aisle can get together and break bread or have a beer together, they're more likely to try to solve a problem together than fight. And just for an example, in terms of the quality of people we have, just last Friday, George Hawkins, who I think has also been on your blog, former CEO of DC Water, came in and gave the keynote address on his moonshot activities. And that was a great talk. He was telling us how he's trying to encourage water agencies to use technology to do things faster, better, and cheaper. And it came off very well. And I think the whole group appreciated it.
Well, that approach of trying to be, I guess, bipartisan, or just that's certainly a valuable approach in these times. I think people can appreciate that. Want to kind of talk about California a bit, and especially your experiences being on the water district and so forth, but also just what's going on in California with water, right?
Sure.
What was it like? What's it like being on a water district board? What's that? What responsibilities are involved in that? How has that shaped your perspective?
One thing that I've learned is that you don't know everything, and water continues to change all the time. So one thing that really encourages me and stimulates me is it's a continually learning experience. You're always learning new things, and water is incredibly complex and incredibly valuable. So I'm really kind of grateful that I've had a chance to learn much about water. And I would say that the water industry is filled with people with high ethics, which, you know, and I've met a lot of folks that have become colleagues and good friends, and I really enjoy that. What's an interesting aspect about what we're doing, and one of my old friends, Bud Lewis, who was the mayor of Carlsbad, and I don't know if you know about the desal plant out here, but the desal plant's named after him. He used to call us a shadow government because while all our meetings are kind of open and transparent, nobody seems to go or generally care. So I'm going to go back to that old defensive back analogy. As long as you're doing your job, you know, nobody really notices. But we do have situations where things go wrong. And again, our job is to try to be a good defensive back and make sure nobody catches a pass in front of us. And, you know, we've had things like droughts and the cryptosporidium crisis in Milwaukee in 93 and that sort of thing, where the whole water industry has had to make changes because of these big events that happen. And typically, because water is such a ubiquitous thing, when bad things happen in one place, they could happen someplace else. And in California, we've been fighting particularly things like droughts. And we've been working together on that. And the old Mark Twain saying of nobody knows the worth of water until the well is dry is really true out here. And again, people don't tend to pay attention. So a lot of meetings we go to, I have one or two meetings a month in the evenings. There's hardly anybody in the audience, which means, frankly, we're doing our job well. Mm-hmm. So what happened in my first meeting in 1990, the Metropolitan Water District was about ready to cut our water deliveries by 50%. And my first meeting that I showed up, and I'd never been in the meeting room before winning that election, it was filled with people angry about the water that was going to be cut off. So they care, but they want to make sure that, you know, actually they want to go on with their daily lives and not have to worry about it. So that's our job, is to take that responsibility off of their shoulders and make sure we provide reliable, high-quality, affordable water and sewer services to our citizens.
Yeah, well, you know, it seems like the public's attention is probably a lot more on water in California these past few years. You know, the drought that's been going on, and the fires, and just the continued growth in the Southern California area. So, do you think there's a little bit more public awareness about what a water utility does, how important these decisions are, how much they should pay attention?
Absolutely. And it was funny you said this would be a 20-minute conversation. I don't have time to give you all the answers on that one, but because you know, there's a lot of stuff going on in California right now. It's actually very, very exciting. But I think what's interesting is California, if you turned us into a country, I think we'd have the fifth largest economy in the world. So we're supporting a very, very large economy. And if you look at sort of the demographics of water in California, most of it falls in the north, and most of the people live in the south. So really, we have a distribution problem here in the state. But I'm proud of how we've done as a state together, all the way from San Diego to Yreka, solving our problems together. But I do want to mention a trend that I think people ought to know about that's a little troubling. And I don't know how this is going to work out, but in 2015, the governor of the state of California, for the first time, applied an across-the-board cut in water deliveries to all urban users. And oddly enough, in San Diego, we had spent $2 billion over the past 20 years developing emergency supplies for exactly that reason. If you look at San Diego, we're effectively a water cul-de-sac. We're in the far southwestern part of the state. And you go south, you're in Mexico. We don't get any water from Mexico. Everything comes from the north. So we had to be very sure that, you know, if problems happened, either natural disasters like earthquakes or droughts, that we were prepared for that sort of thing. So during the last drought, which ended in 17, we had 99% of the water we needed, but we couldn't access it because the governor said we couldn't use it. Now, we've been fighting about that since then, and it's been relieved more recently, and we're getting tons of rain as I look out the window right now, which is good. It's an interesting thing because this is the first time the state came in and tried to solve a problem. Prior to that, the agencies in California, there's about 1,000 water agencies in California, worked together as a group to try to solve these problems. And again, all the way from Yreka to San Diego, even though we have tremendously different situations from a hydraulic standpoint and from a demographic standpoint, we understand that we're all Californians and we're trying to solve that problem. So we did pretty well. And now there's something coming up called a water tax that is showing up in California. I don't know if this exists anywhere else in the country. I don't think it does, but it's a little scary about taxing water, which is something people need to live on to pay for projects. And I'm vastly in disfavor of that. I think we can help solve our problems, you know, internally. There are some issues in Central Valley where there's some people with water delivery problems. But again, we can solve those together without bringing the state in. So it's an interesting situation. If you think about the hydraulics of California, there's 140 million acre feet of water fall on an average year in the state, which is a lot of water. And only 14 million of that is used for municipal use. And the rest is split between, you know, the agriculture and the environment. So how we solve these problems in the next 5 to 10 years is going to be exciting and critical. So we'll be interesting to see how this all unfolds.
Yeah, well, you guys have a lot of attention from the rest of the country and really around the world on water policy and management in California. So it'll be fun to watch how things go, that's for sure. Well, Greg, I appreciate the conversation. I think that on each of these angles, we could keep going and going. There's a lot to talk about, but I appreciate the insights and the information that you shared.
Thank you, Travis. I appreciate the time.
Words on Water.